This is Pittsburgh Explainer from 90.5 WESA. Every week, we help you catch up on some of the biggest news from southwestern Pennsylvania. It's Friday, September 25th. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Liz Reed. Never before in the history of our country has something as ordinary as the mail been so crucial to our democracy. The coronavirus pandemic caused more than a million Pennsylvanians to vote by mail in the June primary, and state officials expect that number to roughly triple in November. With a little over a month until the election, the rules around voting by mail are still in flux as several lawsuits make their way through the courts. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court last week ruled that counties should accept ballots as long as they are postmarked by Friday, November 6th, 3 days after the election. Now, state Republicans say they'll appeal that decision to the U.S. Supreme Court, itself the subject of controversy. GOP senators have vowed to push through a Trump nominee to replace the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg before the fall election. Here to help untangle some of these issues is WITF's Emily Previty, who covers election security and voter processes. Emily, welcome to Explainer.
Thanks, Liz.
Can you just start by summarizing the ruling that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court made last week?
So the state Supreme Court actually did two rulings because there were two cases before them considering or asking similar questions, seeking similar relief. And one case brought by the state Democratic Party was the one where the rulings that we'll talk about in detail actually was made. The other one that had been pending by the Pennsylvania Alliance for Retired Americans, their overlapping claims were essentially dismissed as moot because those issues were answered with the ruling on the Dems case. So in the case of the state Democratic Party, the court decided to extend Pennsylvania's return deadline for ballots postmarked by Election Day by 3 days until Friday, November 6th. The ruling also declared ballot drop boxes to be legal and upheld the state's existing rules saying that campaign poll watchers can only work at polling locations within their county of residence. And it decided that counties must reject ballots that arrive without a second internal envelope called the secrecy envelope. They're also known as naked ballots.
Now, the naked ballot portion of this ruling, which has been snagging headlines across the country for the last week or so, that has been seen as favorable to Republicans, this requirement that you must put your ballot in the secrecy envelope for it to be counted. Why is it seen that way?
So this is being framed as something that's advantageous to Republicans because more Democrats voted by mail in the primary and plan to for the general election, according to polls from multiple sources, including Franklin and Marshall College's Center for Opinion Research, which had poll results out this week. Even if Democrats and Republicans forget to use the secrecy envelope at equal rates, the fact that more Democrats will be using them or voting by mail or are expected to be, that means more Democratic ballots would be invalidated.
Are there other legal challenges in play right now that could affect how Pennsylvanians vote in November? Like, not who they vote for, but literally how they vote.
I know of two other challenges. One is aimed at getting the Department of State to set up a system for delivering ballots electronically to voters, similar to what is already in place for voters who are visually impaired, but no clear details on exactly how it would work if expanded. The other one that was filed a year ago and is seeking to force the state to decertify the Express Vote XL, that machine's in use in Philadelphia, where you have more than a million people registered to vote, and in Cumberland County and Northampton County, and Northampton is considered a swing county. So that case isn't scheduled to be heard until October 15th. And I think people who pay close attention to this stuff would be surprised if that actually results in the machine being shelved this close to the general election. Also, a federal court already declined to decertify that machine in a separate case.
So what do we know for sure right now about how voting is going to work in November?
The deadline to register to vote or update your registration is October 19th. That's less than a month away. So no matter how you vote, that needs to be taken care of. If you're not registered in Pennsylvania or you've moved recently or since the last time you voted, at this point, both mail and in-person voting are options. So within the next week or two or three, those ballots are going to be sent out. No one's indicated plans to consolidate polling places at this juncture, but a coalition of advocacy groups is partnering with the Center for Inclusive Democracy. It's based in California, to create suggested consolidation plans for counties in case they need to consolidate. And I would say that if you vote by mail, make sure to follow the instructions to a T. Use that secrecy envelope and drop off the ballot if you can. Get it in the mail as soon as possible if you can, given the slowdown in mail delivery in some areas. And if you vote in person, give yourself plenty of time. As far as voting in person and voting generally, it's important to stay engaged and pay attention because some rules still could change, even with less than 6 weeks to go until the election. It's frustrating that this confusion or potential for confusion exists, but that's the reality. Your local public media station, whether that's WESA or WITF, where I'm based, or another one of our partners in the network in Pennsylvania, we have multiple reporters covering these issues. So tune in, check the website if you're on Twitter, follow the election reporters, follow the Department of State. DOS has actually been pretty good about getting information out that way.
Emily, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thanks, Liz.
It's time for a quick break. We'll be right back.
I'm Michelle Martin. Here on All Things Considered, we keep you up to date on the news. But we're not here just to give you the sound bites. We're here to help you understand what's really going on, the stories behind the sound bites. In a time when misinformation and even disinformation is everywhere, why not take some time with us this weekend to get the facts? Join us on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Police across the country have come under intense scrutiny in recent months. According to the National Institutes of Health, Black people continue to die at the hands of law enforcement at nearly three times the rate of white people, even though they're less likely to be armed. That scrutiny has also extended to schools, and many districts have severed ties with law enforcement. While Pittsburgh Public Schools currently has no plans to do so, the Board of Directors voted this week to begin gathering more data about arrests in an effort to disrupt the school-to-prison pipeline that disproportionately affects Black students. Here to explain more is WESA's education reporter, Sarah Schneider. Sarah, thanks for being on Explainer.
Yeah, thanks, Liz.
Earlier this year, you reported on a proposal from PPS board members Devin Talaferro and Pam Harbin to collect this data, but also to begin reducing the district's police force next year with the goal of removing police from schools entirely. Sounds like that part is no longer in play.
Right. So they've been working on this resolution for months, and in June, they both told me that they wanted Pittsburgh Public Schools to be police-free. But as you said, that's not in this resolution. This resolution directs the administration to create a task force, and that group will look at, you know, data and talk to teachers and students and school police, and they want it to be a community process. And so reducing the police force could come out of this as a recommendation, but it was not in this initial resolution.
You noted in your reporting that 80% of students arrested over the last 5 years were Black, even though Black students make up just half of the district's student body. So we have data showing that there are disparities. Like, what other data does the district want to collect?
Yeah, we know that there are disparities as a whole, but the district, you know, has 54 buildings. And so they want this data disaggregated. So they want to know, you know, the race and sex of students arrested in each school, and they want to know if those students have a disability. This is data similar to what is reported to the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights, but these two board members want that data posted on the district's website and reported to the board each month. So they want regular updates, and they want the public to know what's happening in each school building. Really, this is like an effort for accountability, because the board does not get these regular reports, so they don't really know what's happening. And so Superintendent Anthony Hamlet, in his own words, said that this report, this one-time report, you know, will help the district understand what, in his words, the root cause of the referral was. So a referral to the juvenile justice system means an arrest or a citation. And these citations are often like a traffic ticket, but it can follow a student. And disorderly conduct is really the issue here. And in the last 5 years, we know that an average of, you know, about 40% of students in PPS are arrested or referred to the juvenile justice system for disorderly conduct. And Taliaferro and Harbin both say it's a highly discretionary offense, and it's subject to implicit and explicit bias.
So when there are arrests or referrals, as you said, for something like, quote, disorderly conduct, are you saying that administrators and the board don't actually know when that data is aggregated, like, what are the range of things that students are being referred for?
Right. Disorderly conduct in the student code of conduct, it's a catch-all phrase. And the Black Girls Equity Alliance, actually, whenever they came out with the report a couple weeks ago, they said that they want that removed from the code of conduct because disorderly conduct could be anything from unreasonable noise, obscene gestures, and language. It's really broad and subjective and can, you know, they...
Things that are not crimes, you know, necessarily.
No, and pretty typical of teenagers, right? Behavior that would be expected from teenagers. And what Superintendent Anthony Hamlet is saying is, if disorderly conduct is the charge, we want to find out what is happening. Like, figure out what's going on with that student, what actually happened, a more holistic approach to
finding alternatives.
Right. The district has been engaged in, you know, restorative practices for several years now. And this is the same thing. If there's unreasonable noise happening in a classroom, there's a reason for that. And they want to find out what's happening with that student.
As a mom of twin toddlers, I know that they're obviously toddlers are a little different than teenagers, but I know there's usually a reason for misbehavior. Sarah, thanks so much for your reporting this week.
Of course. Thanks, Liz.
It's time for another break. Stay with us.
President Trump has attacked his opponent's political record.
Joe Biden has been on the wrong side of history for 47 years.
Biden says four more years of Trump would mean chaos.
You are not safer in Donald Trump's America.
I'm Audie Cornish. Join NPR Tuesday night for special live coverage of the first presidential debate from NPR News.
More than 5,000 people submitted comments to Pittsburgh's Art Commission about the Christopher Columbus statue in Schenley Park. Nearly two-thirds were in favor of removing it, and this week the commission voted unanimously to do just that. Here's Commissioner Sarika Gulashia.
We need to use our voice to amplify others, to pave a way for the future generations to reconnect to their ancestors without fear and oppression, shame or guilt. This is a pivotal moment where we can show our connections as human beings, where our glory cannot ride on another's pain or a single perspective. I vote for the Columbus statue to be removed.
However, this may not be the end of the story. Here to explain is WESA's arts and culture reporter, Bill O'Driscoll. Bill, welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Liz.
The Art Commission voted to remove the statue. So why isn't its removal a foregone conclusion?
Well, there's two reasons. One, there's this disagreement between the Art Commission and the mayor over who has final say over the removal and placement of public artwork. The Art Commission says and refers to part of the city code that seems to say to a layperson that the Art Commission has final say. A two-thirds vote of the Art Commission would allow them to remove a statue, and then the city would have to follow suit. The mayor, however, recently, the city's law department emerged with this reading of the law that says that the mayor really has final authority. In other words, nothing can be removed without the mayor's approval. I'm not sure how this is going to go, really, because when the Stephen Foster statue was removed 3 years ago from Oakland, the Art Commission just voted and the mayor took it down. You know, the city took it down. Public Works guys showed up a few months later and it came down. At the hearing on Wednesday, there was a brief public comment period before the commission voted. And one of the people who spoke, and this was via virtual meeting, of course, online, this guy who identified himself as a lawyer for Basil Russo, who's the national president of the Pittsburgh-based Italian Sons and Daughters of America, he said they were prepared to go to court. In other words, take the city to court over the statue if the Art Commission voted to take it down. And he cited an old city ordinance dating from the 50s that permitted the statue to be erected in the first place and claimed that this ordinance kept the statue, the Columbus statue, where it is in perpetuity, unless, for instance, city council should vote to change the ordinance or like a judge should say this ordinance is unenforceable. So that's another sort of fly in the ointment for those who wish to remove the Columbus statue.
Okay, I want to take these one at a time. Peduto is saying it's his call, ultimately, whether or not the statue comes down. Has he indicated where he'll fall on this? If he agreed with the commission, why would he be insisting that it's his call, having already gone through this with the Stephen Foster statue? I mean, do you have any sense of what his feelings are?
Peduto has not expressed any preference as to whether the statue goes or stays. An assistant city solicitor who spoke to the Art Commission back in August and got in quite a heated discussion with him about the interpretation of who has final say said that the mayor is likely to, I'm paraphrasing here, is likely to do whatever the commission votes. She was representing the commission as being this advisory body which can recommend what to do with the statue and said that Peduto would be likely to follow their recommendation. I've talked to a bunch of people sort of behind the scenes, off the record, and nobody either knows or is willing to say where the mayor stands on this or why he's now pushing this interpretation of the law that he has final say, because it would seem to be like politically easier to just say, you know, look, this is up to the Art Commission. I don't have any say in whether it comes down. And to the extent that he's going to anger one party or another, he could just sort of, you know, pass the buck to the Art Commission legitimately based on precedent and, you know, sort of avoid any kind of backlash for that.
Moving to the other fly in the ointment, as you put it, the Italian Sons and Daughters of America is a national organization that's based here in Pittsburgh. Have they fought other statue removals elsewhere in the country?
I don't know that they have, but this lawyer who the national president has retained, named George Bichetto, is the lawyer for the Friends of Marconi Plaza in Philadelphia. Marconi Plaza is located in South Philadelphia, which is historically this Italian-American neighborhood. There's a Columbus statue that stood there since 1876, believe it or not. And Philadelphia's Art Commission voted in August to remove that statue for much the same reason that Pittsburgh's just did. And this Friends of Marconi Plaza group retained this attorney to fight that, and in fact they got a stay from a judge, so that statue is still up, but its fate is kind of in limbo right now. So it seems like they're trying to take the same tack here.
What are the next steps with Pittsburgh's Columbus statue? Is that even clear right now?
It's not totally clear. I would have to say we'd have to wait and see what the mayor says, what Mayor Peduto says. If he abides by what he calls the commission's recommendation and what the commission calls its decision, then we shouldn't have a problem on that front anyway. There still might be a court battle involved. Should he decide to go against what the commission voted on, then there's a problem because the commission can't, you know, send a public works crew out to take down the statue on its own. That's really up to the mayor. The other possibility, of course, is he just delays making a decision. We're, you know, a couple weeks here from Columbus Day. he might not want to make a decision to remove the Columbus statue. You know, with that looming, he might wait, even if he is going to decide that he agrees to take it down. You know, there's also the issue of if this goes on too long, are protesters going to take this into their own hands as they've done in other cities, especially with Columbus Day coming up? Is the city going to have people guarding, like police guarding the Columbus statue here, as happened in Philadelphia, because they're afraid people will vandalize it or take it down? These are all possibilities, and I don't think anybody really totally knows what's going to happen at this point.
Bill, thanks so much for helping us understand this.
Sure thing.
That's Pittsburgh Explainer for this week. Our show is produced by Katie Blackley. Christopher Ayers is our editor. You can find all of our news coverage at our website, WESA.FM, and of course on the air at 90.5 FM. I'm your host, Liz Reed. Thanks for listening. Let's talk next week.